Welcome to ACM SIGMOD Records series of interviews with distinguished members of the database community. I'm Marianne Winslet, and today we're in Phoenix, the site of the 2012 SIGMOD and PODS conference. I have here with me Rick Snodgrass, who's a professor of computer science at the University of Arizona. Rick has served as the editor-in-chief of ACM Transactions on Database Systems, the chair of ACM SIGMOD, the ACM Pubs Board, and the ACM History Committee. He's received the SIGMOD Outstanding Contributions Award and ACM Outstanding Contribution Award, and he's an ACM Fellow. Rick's PhD is from Carnegie Mellon University. So, Rick, welcome.
Thank you.
Rick, you're best known for your work on temporal databases, and you even worked hard to get temporal constructs into the SQL standard. What role do you think database researchers should play in the standards community?
I think it's very important for the database researchers to have a role. Unfortunately, the way that the committee is set up, the standards committee, it's run by vendors, it's funded by vendors. It's very hard to spend time with them. They're open to having people come in, but it's has to be funded by the researchers. So I would actually like to have the committee be more accepting of people from our research community and actually pay for them to come in and invite them in. For example, the standards, the nascent standards, are closed. They don't even release them to the community for comment until they've been finalized. I think there should be much more of a dialogue with the research community.
Are there mistakes, mistakes in quotes, that we could have prevented if we'd been more involved with that?
I think the standard is a very big standard. It's thousands of pages long. And I think perhaps had we been involved, we could have found more foundational aspects to reduce the redundancy in the standard. So that might have been one place. I don't know if that's a mistake, but certainly more input is better, I think.
A standard that's thousands of pages long, it sounds like almost a contradiction in terms to me. How can anyone understand?
I don't think anyone totally understands. I think it's about 4,000 pages, so yeah.
4,000?
I think the standards body, the people that did it, who have been working on it for decades, understand it very well. But us normal mortals, I don't think so.
And then isn't there a gap between what the standard says and what people actually implement it?
Yes. So it's much bigger than what most DBMSs implement, although each DBMS implements a portion of it. And, of course, there are a lot of inconsistencies between the standard and implementations.
So in what sense is it a standard then if people don't implement all of it and then the parts they do implement are inconsistent?
Well, it's better than having a free-for-all.
Where
they're all different. So there is some compatibility, and so we should be happy for that.
So I guess in industry, there are incentives for diversity, that people can't switch between products so easily. And maybe are there also incentives? What are the incentives for standardization?
I don't think that in the industry there the standards process is very interesting because you've got all these vendors who are competing with each other, getting in the same room and trying to come up with something that's a standard. And so that really shouldn't work. And so it's amazing how well it does work, given that situation. They're all very much competitors, and they each want to win. And so the fact that we get anything at all, I think we should celebrate.
People are saying that the relational temporal database constructs don't apply to graph databases, for example, in biology. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. Actually, I've done some work with temporal XML graph data. And I think the underlying concepts like sequenced apply directly. Well, databases have foreign keys, and that's a lot like a tree structure also, or graph structure. So I think that if we get to the foundational concepts, hopefully it should apply with modification anywhere.
What parts need to be changed to move to graph databases?
I think the ideas need to be applied to that specific place. So when we did our work with temporal XML, mm-hmm. we had to figure out what were the unique aspects mm-hmm. of XML. But there are actually very few. If you have an XQuery query mm-hmm. On XML, you can say, I want to evaluate that on a temporal document at each point in time.
Uh-huh.
That's
uh-huh.
what sequence does.
Yeah.
So that applies directly.
I see.
Now, how you actually implement that efficiently mm-hmm. is a complex problem. Mm. But at least you know what the semantics should be.
Uh-huh. Okay. You have a project right now on ergolics.
Yes.
What is that?
Ergolics. So ergolics is from the Greek word erg, which means work uh-huh. or tool.
Uh-huh.
And so it's taking computational tools like DBMSs, compilers, whatever, and it's a science of computational tools. And the reason we needed this word is because computer science has the word science. So the science of computer science is a very awkward formulation. And so uh-huh. I came up with this word, ergolics. I did a Google search, and no one's used the word.
Okay.
So it's a new word. Computer science really has three different perspectives in it. One is mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
So dependency theory, asymptotic complexity. Another one is engineering. Most of what we do is engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Engineering is doing something better, faster, cheaper. So you're always trying to do a better job. And mm-hmm. most of SIGMOD papers, for instance, most of POD's papers are in the mathematical perspective.
Yeah.
Most of SIGMOD is in engineering. We have actually very little science methodology, predictive theories.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we need to also go. That doesn't mean the other two perspectives aren't just as valid.
Uh-huh.
Mathematics can oftentimes inform science,
mm-hmm.
and science can inform engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, that centerpiece is not there. So we jump from mathematics to engineering. I think that really good engineers have intuitive understanding of the predictive rules by which these things work, these computational tools. But we haven't yet articulated those.
So what would they look like in the case of databases?
So I've been working on that for quite a while. It's very, very difficult research in that whenever I find something, I want to see, well, why is that? And I want to look in the code.
Yeah.
So the way I find to think about this is treat a DBMS like a biologist would treat a rabbit.
Okay.
So a biologist looks at a rabbit and says, this rabbit has big ears.
Yeah.
Why might that be? Well, maybe it's because they need to hear better.
Uh-huh.
Well, but there are other animals that need to hear better that don't have big ears. So why do rabbits, especially in the desert, rabbits have the biggest ears.
Uh-huh.
So maybe it's because they need to release heat. Well, then you could do studies and experiments. In that case, blood flow in the ears would make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You do not ask, a biologist does not say, how do I make a rabbit run faster? Maybe if I make the legs longer,
uh-huh.
that's not a question you ask. You
uh-huh.
ask why. Why is the rabbit the way it is?
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking for predictive theories about DBMSs
mm-hmm.
That would apply across DBMSs.
Mm-hmm.
So SQL Server, DB2, Oracle, Teradata, these are implemented by different people.
Mm-hmm.
They're totally different products. What are things that we could say about them in general?
Well, okay, but... Rabbits are evolving, but slowly. And these DBMSs are evolving super fast, at least we hope they're evolving fast.
Actually, most of their foundational parts have been around for close to 30 years.
Okay.
I mean, cost-based query optimization,
uh-huh.
Locking, concurrency control.
Uh-huh.
So actually, there's a lot that's remained pretty steady. And so we can ask questions about them. For instance, if you add a query operator, relational operator,
uh-huh.
What will happen to the amount of optimal plans?
Wait, wouldn't that be you mean a new kind of operator? Or just,
yeah, not in the language.
That's like adding a fifth leg to a rabbit.
So this is informing the engineering. So
uh-huh.
right now we would say, I want to make some queries run faster,
yeah.
so I'll add a certain kind of index.
Okay.
Or another kind of relational operator.
Yeah.
That has the benefit of making some queries faster.
Right.
So that's good. It also makes the optimizer more complex.
True.
So we're going to have more mistakes. suboptimal plans.
Okay.
So do you get more of an advantage or a disadvantage? Is there a point at which, when you're adding an operator, on average, you actually slow down the DBMS?
Uh-huh.
That's a question that you really can't ask about a single DBMS. You have to ask it across the class.
And what's the answer to that one?
I'm still working on that.
Okay.
So we don't know that.
Okay.
That's a very interesting question for engineering.
Uh-huh.
That's just one of many.
Well, at 4,000 pages, maybe we're approaching the point at which the next 1,000 pages would just bring it downhill.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, one of the complaints against Ergalix is, well, these are programs. We understand programs. I mean, we can look and see exactly how they work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a DBMS is so complex,
yeah.
No one understands it.
Right.
And so now we need to get into that. And science deals with the universe, which is also very complex.
Uh-huh.
They've got a whole bunch of methodologies that we could use
okay.
to understand these very complicated things.
So can you give me an example of an insight that you've gotten to date using this approach?
It looks like as you add operators, you do have an increase in suboptimality. And so it looks like there is a limit at which point we're not going to be able
diminishing.
To add.
Okay.
Diminishing returns, and then it actually goes the other way.
Okay, and do you know yet whether we've already reached the limit?
I haven't gotten the theory to the point where it's that specific yet.
Okay, good. In the database research community, we don't often think about branding, but I know that
yes.
you do. So I guess I'll start with a little story. So Jiawei Han told me that we needed to change the name of our research group at Illinois, and we did. So now we used to be called the Database and Information Systems Group, and now we're the Data and Information Systems Group. And Jiawei said that if we call ourselves Database Group, everybody who's not in this area thinks that databases are a solved problem, and therefore we're not really doing anything interesting. So this maybe is an example of a branding issue. So what do you think we need to do in the database community in terms of our brand?
So I think brands are very, very important.
Uh-huh.
And since we're in the Southwest, we first need to define what branding is.
Okay.
It's not what you do to cattle.
Uh-huh.
To identify them. We're not talking about burning
uh-huh.
signs on their hides.
Yeah.
We're talking about identifying in the minds of people, what does this discipline or what does this person do? My wife is a marketing professor, and so that's how I know about branding. And disciplines have brands. Departments have brands. Universities have brands. And people have brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very important for people to think about what their brand is. As far as the discipline, I totally agree with Jiawei that DBMSs are viewed as a solved problem. Now,
mm-hmm.
we're still trying to do better. We're still trying to do more engineering. But DBMSs are wonderfully efficient and powerful tools right now. So going from DBMSs or databases to data, I think, is exactly the right place that our discipline needs to go. We really understand data very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a skill that the world needs,
mm-hmm.
scientists need actually for their data,
mm-hmm.
engineers need it for their data,
mm-hmm.
Even experimental mathematicians need it for their data.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot to give the whole world.
Well, should we be the data management research or information management research?
So I see information as being data with insight.
Mm-hmm.
You're adding insight.
Mm-hmm.
And there is actually a hierarchy from data to information
mm-hmm.
to knowledge
mm-hmm.
to wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are experts at the first couple.
Mm-hmm.
You get into philosophy when you get up to the wisdom part
mm-hmm.
or morality or whatever. But certainly those first few steps, which are very important, I think we have a lot to add.
So do we need to change our current brand, or is it already in the right place?
Well, this is a special interest group of management of data. It's not management of databases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, SIGMOD, I think, actually has the right name.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, for instance, IEEE Data Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
They're only looking at a third of the thing.
I see.
Whereas we can look at the mathematics
uh-huh.
of data, the science of data, and
uh-huh.
the engineering of data.
Okay. Well, all those people out there who would say, I'm in the database group, what should they be saying instead?
I mean, if they're interested in databases and doing that, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that us as a discipline, as a society, but also as a general discipline, should necessarily limit ourselves that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a new name is called for?
Or just emphasizing MOD, management of data,
and
going back to that.
All right. What about personal branding as researchers? How should we handle that?
So I wrote a paper actually with my wife, Mary Brooks, on this with a whole bunch of different approaches for personal branding.
Mm-hmm.
The goal here is to come up with a single phrase that when people hear that phrase, they think of you. And when they think of you, they think of that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So in my career, I've branded myself as temporal databases.
Yep. Yep.
So when people need a temporal database guy on their programming committee, they think of me and they think of some other people.
Mm-hmm.
And when they think of me, they think of temporal databases.
Uh-huh.
How have I helped that? I've written glossaries, I've written surveys, I've written papers, most of which have the word temporal database, if not in the title, then in the abstract. I'm now going towards science of computer science. That's what I've been working on the last few years. That's an awkward phrase, so I came up with a new word.
Yeah.
If you Google or Galax, you'll see my name.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, when you think of Rick Snodgrass, maybe you'll think of Ergalix.
Okay.
So this is a way to... A lot of people have a problem with this because they see it as limiting.
Yeah.
But you get to pick what you want to be associated with you.
All right. Well, then let's pick on Jim Gray because he's not here, literally. Mm-hmm. He's not here. So what is Jim Gray's brand? He's arguably our most successful researcher.
I would argue his brand is integration of research approaches. So he talked to everyone.
Yeah.
And he knew what pretty much everyone was doing.
Yeah.
And he could help them figure out how they fit into the big picture. And he could articulate that big picture. So that's what I see his brand is. So a brand can be a topic.
Yeah.
It can be an approach.
Uh-huh.
It can be a methodology.
Uh-huh.
It can be a special ability like Jim Gray's.
I see. Okay. And then can we pick on some other people who maybe are a little more here? So what's David DeWitt's brand?
David DeWitt is very articulate
and
controversial. And so when he says something, people want to hear what he says. And he's brilliant, so you really want to. And so he's very good at bringing problems to the community and bringing solutions and bringing places where we're not doing very well. Which is very helpful for us.
Okay.
He's a fantastic person to be on a panel for this reason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's exciting to listen to.
Yes, because he can identify these issues. He did a talk on roadkill on the information highway. Perfect for telling us how we missed the boat in terms of the web. The web is a big database, but that's not how it's viewed. So that's a good example.
That's how we view it, but yeah. I guess it's not how the world.
That's right. We are roadkill on
toy.
This. Yeah.
Okay. This reminds me of the fact that you're on the ACM History Committee. So
I'm no longer. I went off about a year ago.
Okay, you were on the ACM History Committee. It's now history that you were on the ACM History Committee. And computer science is all about, in my mind, inventing the future. So what role does history play in a community that's all about creating a new version of history, so to speak?
Couple of different responses. One is that our history is, as I said, databases is 50 years old. That means that the people that started are getting very old. So we're about to lose a lot of our history.
Mm-hmm.
And so the History Committee has commissioned a lot of interviews with these early pioneers. For instance, Charlie Bachman was interviewed by SIGMOD. SIGMOD paid for that interview by a professional historian. So I went and looked at... Everyone should read his interview on the ACM Digital Library. It talks about IDS, his original system, which was an amazing system, which has a lot of similarities, actually, with the most recent systems. It was a main memory database system that used virtual memory, for instance. Pretty amazing. We wouldn't have that without a history committee in ACM. We need to grab our history before it goes away.
Yeah.
We always are looking to the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And so we're going to be losing this very vibrant history we have. Now, we're not like physics or mathematics, which has hundreds or thousands of years, but that's good. We can actually capture that.
Yeah.
And we can put it in a digital form using the technology we invented.
Well, I think we need to reprint Charlie Bachman's interview in the SIGMOD record.
Well, it's 162 pages long.
162
yes.
pages?
It was a two-day interview. I have to tell a quick story. I got a call a couple years ago from Charlie Bachman saying, why don't you come over to my house? I'm just finished the interview. And so I said, well, where do you live? And it turns out he lives a mile and a half from my house in Tucson at that time.
Wow.
So I went over there, and Tom Hay was there. He had just finished the first, I guess the second day of interviews. And Charlie walked up and said, would you like some nuts? And held out a little tray.
Yeah.
And I realized that that was the Turing Award bowl.
Oh!
So I got to get a nut out of the Turing Award bowl from Charlie Bachman. But you mentioned Jim Gray. Jim Gray is no longer with us. We didn't ever interview him. And so that's a loss. And Ted Codd is no longer with us.
Yeah.
So what you are doing through these interviews with the other people you're interviewing is going to be very valuable 20 or 30 years in the future.
Okay.
As well as now.
Well, I decided to go back to the first ones and see what people were predicting and how much of it has come true. So we can compare our historical projections against reality.
And I'll bet you we're pretty bad at that.
I don't know. I'll check it out. So, speaking of changing over time, how has ACM's publications changed over time?
Oh, excellent question. So, if you go back, say, 14 years, at this conference in 14 years, was 1998. I think that was in Philadelphia.
Okay.
So, if you went to, I don't know if you went to that conference, you got a bound printed version of the proceedings.
True.
And you took it back, and well, the other ones you went to at that time, you put them on your shelf. And I'm sure you had a shelf full of proceedings because that was how you got papers.
Yep.
If you didn't have it in your office, you had to go down to the library to get it.
Yes.
14 years ago. So SIGMOD, our community, decided to scan all of those proceedings and put them in digital PDFs. Not only that, they talked to all the other database societies and helped pay for, but also encouraged them to scan theirs. 5 years later, SIGMOD gave to all of its members the ACM the SIGMOD Anthology, two DVDs with 150,000 pages of database papers. And then SIGMOD went to ACM and said, other SIGs, you should do the same thing. So the SIGs paid for digitizing the entire past history of the of all of their conferences and journals. That formed the ACM Digital Library. Then IEEE, we already had done data engineering because SIGMOD worked with them, decided to digitize all their past. So because of SIGMOD, and the SIGMOD dues, which help pay for this, all of the computer science papers are now digitized.
Well, you would like that if for no other reason than it's history. But if you look at the accesses to the library, which of course I've never done, but how much do people look at that older stuff?
I'm not sure. I think that they would learn a lot by going back further than the last few years in their areas. They need to do directed search. I mean, you don't just pick up a paper and read it. But for the very specific things they're working on, it would be useful. For instance, I was reading Charlie Bachman's interview, and I sent a note to my PhD student saying, he's doing something that you're doing. You should reference it in your dissertation to give some historical context. The next step, though, from just digitizing is search, and of course Google gives us full search through Google Scholar and others, Microsoft. And so we can use this and we can get access so much easier than when you and I were doing it 14 years ago when we had to go to the library.
Yeah.
If the library didn't have it, we'd have to ask them to buy it, which would take weeks. Now it's available in seconds. So there's really no excuse for not having a accurate and complete kind of provenance of the ideas that you're working on.
That brings me to a related question. So scientists complain that in computer science we don't cite things correctly. So that, for example, I've heard that every, you know, paper we write about databases should be citing the original paper by Codd. And we just don't do that.
Yeah.
So should we, or are they just talking from their own perspective?
I don't know how useful it is to cite for everyone to cite Codd. I think that it's very important to put each person's work in context, and that's bigger than the last 2 years. But I think a more insightful citation where you say, these are the important precursor ideas, and these are the best place where each of those ideas is described, I think would be much more efficient. So I guess I disagree with the scientists.
Okay. And also reminds me of the idea that there's nothing new under the sun. In fact, when Codd proposed relational databases, it was actually the third time they'd been proposed, the first, I think, being maybe von Neumann in 1945 or something. But maybe this ability to reinvent ourselves with, maybe our ability to ignore history and the fact that it failed all these previous times enables us to keep trying the same things, and then finally the third time it worked.
So I'm not sure they're the same things. They're probably the core of the idea, the kernel of the idea, but it's how you place it in the current context which determines whether or not it's going to be accepted. So I had a colleague who said, I never read any of the research because I don't want to be biased. I want to do my own thing. And I thought, how inefficient can that be? Because you're reinventing the wheel that other people have already invented. So I think one can go too far and just spending all one's time reading.
Yeah.
And one can go too far and not read anything. It requires some real skill to figure out where that middle ground is.
Okay. So you had 6 undergrads involved in your research projects last year, and under funding from NSF's Research Experience for Undergraduates program. Why bother to write those grants?
So number one,
proposals. Yeah.
Number one, they're really easy to get. They fund almost all of them because they don't get very many. So if you want a few extra undergraduates, go for it. I think that 6 was too many for me. I think 3 would have been just about right. So there's a few tricks. It's important to use your graduate students to help direct them. But I just love working with undergraduates.
Why?
Because they're just starting out research. They don't know what research is. So it's this big, scary, wondrous world. They're not jaded at all, by, like some graduate students are and a lot of professors are. It's to them, it's totally new. And they really are the future. And also I have to explain things very simply to them.
Yes.
And it's hard to explain things simply, but when I understand it, I can better. So that forces me to do that. And so, and also I'm a professor. This is my profession. And teaching is part of it. And so I want to find the brightest students and spend time with them.
Okay. Maybe I should add that we, my own group, we also have tons of, my skeptical question is a little misleading because we have huge numbers of RU students in my own group.
Cool.
So
they're
maybe
fun,
it was a little
they?
Misleading the way I asked that. I don't want people to get the wrong impression. I think we had 5 last year. Yeah.
And they're wonderful to work with, aren't they?
We found it, it benefits both us and them. In fact, my research center in Singapore, we've had 44 interns so far, and we just finished our 3rd year.
That's wow, undergraduates.
Some are grads, but let's say 90% are undergrads.
Well, that's incredible. That's wonderful.
It works really well for us. Okay, but this is about you, not about me, so let me ask my next question, which is that I'm told that at work your door is always open. How do you maintain your focus if your door's already if your doors are always open?
I don't know if I do. I find it very hard to context switch.
Uh-huh.
So I've been working at strategies for doing that.
Uh-huh.
But I find that at the end of the day, the time I spent with my students is the most fun.
Uh-huh.
And so much more fun than sitting by myself writing a paper. But I think it can get me very scattered. And that's another trade-off that I'm still working on.
Okay. But it sounds like since you have the open door policy, in some sense you're benefiting more from the interruptions than...
Actually, my door is closed, but I have a policy that you can knock any time. So if they knock and I'm in, I'll say, can I talk with you in a little while?
Uh-huh.
I find if the door is actually open, just people walking by is very distracting.
Ah, okay.
So I work very hard to manage my physical space for more effectiveness.
Okay. Do you have any words of advice for fledgling or mid-career database researchers or practitioners?
So I have no words of advice for practitioners because I have not one.
Mm-hmm.
I have great respect for them. They
mm-hmm.
have their own set of challenges.
Uh-huh.
For mid-career, one word of advice would be to figure out, this is related to branding, what you are best at.
Mm-hmm.
And to really think about that and then do things that utilize that.
Mm-hmm.
Don Knuth once said that he picks problems where he is the best person in the world to solve those problems,
mm-hmm.
given his background.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great approach.
Mm-hmm.
To really think deeply about what special abilities you bring. And I think that will also increase the passion, which is really important.
Mm-hmm. Good advice. From among all your past research, do you have a favorite piece of work?
I do. It's the last book I wrote on temporal databases, and it really encapsulated the ordination framework that I've been developing over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's three sets of three, which I like that symmetry. So it's different kinds of time. So there's periods, instance, and intervals.
Mm-hmm.
There's three kinds of time in databases. There's valid time, transaction time, and bitemporal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's three kinds of queries, current, sequence, and non-sequenced. And all that kind of came together in the book. And it was really, really satisfying to see those ideas coming out in the new standard. It just came out in October, last October.
Great. If you magically had enough extra time to do one additional thing at work that you're not doing now, what would it be?
So I don't like that question.
And
let me tell you why specifically. I don't like that question. Because it sounds like what should I have done? You didn't say should, but my philosophy is that actually being a temporal database guy, the only thing that exists is the present.
No, but it's about your future.
So that's right. So that's how I like to think about it. What would I do now that I'm not doing,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't
if you
do
had
before?
Extra time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not if I have extra time because I'm not going to have extra time. It's what would I emphasize now
mm-hmm.
versus not emphasizing something else.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to push Ergalix. And so that's what I'm really focusing on, and I'm not doing other things so I can do that.
Okay. If you could change one thing about yourself as a computer science researcher, what would it be?
So for the future,
mm-hmm.
what would I do differently as a computer science researcher? I need to learn a lot more about statistics
uh-huh.
and about the philosophy of science.
Uh-huh.
How does science, because I am not trained in that. I've got an undergraduate degree in physics,
mm-hmm.
but after that I was trained to be a computer scientist,
mm-hmm.
so I know how to make that rabbit run faster.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to study that rabbit. And
mm-hmm.
so that's what I've really been focusing on, and it's been really, really fun.
Great. Thanks so much for talking to me today, Rick.
Thank you.